the midweek drive, zooming into the future and energized by the now.
The Midweek Drive Team, four words which signify quality and all that's best in audio entertainment.
Observational skills, attention to detail, problem-solving ability, intelligence, sharp memory, and patience. You could say attributes that we all need in certain ways, but what about fictional characters, specifically fictional inspectors and indeed detectives? What about Detective Superintendent Roy Grace? I'm sure you must have heard of him. He's an awesome character and indeed creator and creation of the terribly, terribly, terribly talented individual, Peter James. How are you, Peter?
Alex, thank you. That's a nice build-up. I'm good and delighted to be talking to you.
Well, it's great to connect with your good self, of course. And we're specifically talking about the latest incarnation of course, Detective Superintendent Roy Grace, that Stop Them Dead, which takes us into the world of canines, I believe.
It does. Every book that I embark on is of a Roy Grace novel, it's going to be a year of my life. So I always, when I'm starting out, I think, what do I actually want to spend the year of my life writing and learning about? And it's a really strange thing. Book's subject seems to find me. And this happened about 2.5 years ago. I was reading an article in the local Brighton paper, The Argus, and it was a woman walking her Springer Spaniel in a park in the center of the city, and she was mugged, and the dog was stolen. And I read on further, and I said the dog was worth £5,000. And I was just, I was A, staggered, but B, completely horrified, because I'm a massive dog lover, as is my wife. And I thought, if you were mugged, that's a pretty horrible thing. But, you know, if they stole your purse or your wallet or your watch, you could probably get some of it back on insurance. If they stole your dog, the heartbreak is just unimaginable. Mm. You know, the dog is a part of your life. It's a part of your soul. And I thought, if one of our two gorgeous dogs was stolen, I'd never rest until they were found, because you'd be thinking, where are they? What monsters got them? How are they being treated? And I had a meeting with the chief constable of Sussex a few days later. And I said, what's that about? And she said, that is the tip of an iceberg. Just before I go on, I do want to just say, for everyone listening who loves dogs or animals in general, I've not portrayed any dog being harmed in the book. I've portrayed plenty of dog villains being harmed, but you needn't worry if you're worried that you might read something horrible about a dog. You won't. I couldn't write that.
That's good to hear, Peter, because certainly they are our best friends, and we don't want to obviously sort of upset owners in all sorts of ways. Presumably, though, the very fact that you got a DS Roy Grace on the case, so to speak, means that we'll have a suitable denouement to the whole experience.
We will indeed. Yes, I learned that basically the cost of dogs just went crazy during lockdown. They literally went up 10 times. And I've worked quite closely with the RSPCA and with Sussex Police. And it became during lockdown, and still is, epidemic across the UK, organised crime gangs making more money out of either stealing dogs, illegally importing them, or illegally breeding them in these horrific puppy farms. They're making more money than drugs. And with drugs, they're looking at a prison sentence of 5 to 15 years if they get caught. Illegally trading in dogs, the maximum sentence is about 6 months. Mm. So it's massively tempting. Roy Grace first becomes involved in the Stop Them Dead starts with a farmer who's murdered trying to stop a group of gangsters basically stealing dogs from his farm. And then Roy becomes further involved, in fact, without it giving a spoiler, when his and Cleo's own dog gets stolen. And I've written it as a thriller, but I've worked very closely with the RSPCA throughout the book, and I've put in some key messages for the RSPCA, so that if you read the book, you'll learn at least how not how to avoid buying a stolen or a illegally imported puppy.
Very, very much important, and it's a wonderful experience of actually not only having a cracking detective novel, but also a little bit of positive information and life advice as well. Now, arguably, the whole detective genre, people will say, oh, well, it's Hercule Poirot and it's Agatha Christie. You can go back to Edgar Allan Poe, of course, and his murder mystery scenarios, and obviously Conan Doyle and others. But this fascination, I mean, we started off this piece, Peter, by talking about those key characteristics of top fictional detectives. Is that something that you effectively feel, yeah, that basically is Roy Grace to a T, or is it a case of you have other influences that might have fed into the DNA of Roy Grace, whether it be Jessica Fletcher or indeed Sherlock Holmes himself?
There's definitely, I think Sherlock Holmes, probably there's an influence of Sherlock Holmes in every crime writer living. He such an awesome, inspired creation. But the real inspiration for Roy Grace came from a real life detective in Brighton, who I met back in 1997. His name is Dave Gaylor. He was then a young detective inspector. And I had a meeting with him, and he said, what are you writing at the moment? And I was writing a psychological thriller called Denial. And he said, tell me about it. So I started telling him, he said, hang on, stop there. Why has your detective not got an outside inquiry team doing this? Don't you think your character would have done that, not this? And I thought, wow, this guy has got a really creative brain. And he helped me. We became friends, and he helped me on the next three novels. And he rose to become Detective Chief Superintendent, effectively head of major crime for Sussex in 2002. And coincidentally, my publisher said to me, have you ever thought of creating a fictional detective for a crime series? So I went to Dave Gaylor. I said, how'd you like to be a fictional cop? And he loved the idea. He is my Roy Grace. He doesn't look like him. But we've worked together on every Roy Grace, all 19 of them, and currently on the 20th one. And he helps me get that authenticity that's so important, which is in terms of how Roy deals with things, how all the policing characters act and behave and even talk. Because I think that what's really important for me in fiction is that, you know, everybody who reads is intelligent, and you know, we want to not just read a good story, we actually want to learn something. And I think readers can tell very quickly if something feels authentic or it doesn't. And you mentioned Holmes and Poirot and Miss Marple. They were great detectives, but what was quite interesting was I don't think throughout the Holmes, the four Holmes novels and all the stories, and throughout all the Marples and the Poirots, they are exactly the same people at the beginning and end of each book. Whereas in real life, all the detectives I've ever met have been changed by the experiences they go through, you know, by all the dark things they see. Every police officer I ever meet, I say, do you think you're a different person to when you first went in the police? And they all say yes. Yeah, the experience, you know, they've all become, in a way, more cynical. But also, I think many of them have actually become more caring rather than less caring.
I always like to say perhaps we should be sceptical as opposed to cynical, because there is that notion that a cynic is somebody who, when they smell flowers, they look around for the coffin. Or maybe that is actually what happens when you're working in detective work. You mentioned, of course, that there have been 19 Roy Grace novels to date. This is the 20th. All the others have obviously gone to number one in Sunday Times bestseller list. Presumably, the Stop Them Dead will also follow through that pathway.
I really hope so. And also, I do have a little treat for not just Roy Grace fans, but for anybody at the back of Stop Them Dead are the first seven chapters of a standalone, which is actually a spin-off about Roy Grace's missing wife. You know, when we first meet him in Dead Simple, at the start of the series, we learn that his wife, Sandy, who he loved and adored, had vanished off the face of the earth. And he spent 9 years looking for her, unsure whether she was alive or dead, murdered, kidnapped, run off with a lover. And it's coming out next May, and it's called They Thought I Was Dead, Sandy's story.
Sounds awesome. And presumably, Peter, there's no intention to do a kind of mashup and actually have Inspector Roy Grace, or Superintendent, I should say, Roy Grace, grow a wax moustache, wear a deer stalker, and actually start autobiographically typing his own stories.
No chance whatsoever. I think I'd be murdered by my readers.
Good to hear. Excellent stuff. Stop Them Dead is available through all good channels now. It's well worth going to access from that point of view. Peter, will you be doing the book festival scene? Because obviously that's coming around, and I can already feel that the joys of the New York Book Festival, the Hay on Wye Festival, they'll be desperately keen to feature you.
I do some of the festivals every year. I'm doing one in Yeovil actually in October, which is kind of fun, which I've not done before. And I did Capital Crime a few weeks ago, and I will be doing more. So I put all my appearances up on my website on peterjames.com. There's a section called Appearances. So do keep a, if you're interested in coming to one of my events, just keep a look on that and
Fantastic.
report it up as soon as it's announced. And also, Grace Television with John Sims, season 4's just wrapped shooting, and that'll be on ITV on ITV1 on Sunday nights, probably late January or February in the new year.
For fans of Detective Superintendent Roy Grace, and they are growing on a daily basis, clearly it's a good time. And they're not being stopped dead at all. But Peter James, we salute you today. The book is, of course, is called Stop Them Dead. Many thanks indeed. And keep on writing, Peter.
Thank you so much. I will try.
Leave this place until I know who did it.
A ghost killed her.
There must be a rational answer for all of this.
Just admit that you are up against something bigger than you.
No!
You were saying...
Something in this house tried to kill me.
Don't look at me like I'm suspect. We're old friends.
Every murderer is somebody's old friend.
No one shall leave until I find if the living have been killed by the dead.
You have been hiding here all this time.
Who are you talking to?
Well, I wonder if you actually agree with those top six characteristics of the ultimate fictional detective. We talked obviously to author Peter James earlier. He's the creator of Detective Superintendent Roy Grace, and he clearly actually had key themes to say with that. But just a reminder, if you're wondering about what those personality skills are that actually make the ultimate fictional detective, observational skills, attention to detail, problem-solving ability, intelligence, a sharp memory, and patience. Now, the big question is, of course, will that list of six characteristics apply to either Inspector Red Riding Hood or the joys and wonderment of the moustache of Kenneth Branagh in, of course, A Haunting in Venice? Well, of course, we're talking about Hercule Poirot. Well, let's find out what Richard Fitzwilliams makes of A Haunting in Venice, because you've already heard that when it comes to mustaches, clearly Albert Finney, the wondrousness of David Suchet, and indeed interesting views of Peter Ustimov, they cannot match the terrific nature of the mustache that exists within Kenneth Branagh. I mean, that is a done deal. Apart from that, did you enjoy the movie?
Well, I have to say, firstly, it's interesting following various actors as Poirot. As you know, I'm particularly fond of David Suchet, who I think was quintessentially the ideal Poirot, certainly the Agatha Christie version, which of course is the source. Peter Ustinov, yes, definitely the presence. Finney, I thought, was like a jack in the box. I found him like a waxwork that had gone berserk. Interesting, however, with Kenneth Branagh, when we're actually looking at as characters. I mean, he directs. He's made three films: The Orient Express, A Death in the Nile, now this one. This is a different Poirot from his others, because you mentioned the moustaches, and I mean, it got silly before, quite frankly. It really did get ridiculous. He had a sort of squirrel-like facial hair. This is a serious Poirot, and he's much more restrained. He is restrained, but what makes this film fascinating, and I was hooked by it, is that whoever was responsible for the sound and the photography, the combination of those, was anything but restrained, and that's what makes it such fun. One does have to say that if you set a haunting in Venice in a villa near a canal, which is in the middle of a storm, and my goodness me, they use the special effects. I mean, most effectively, I have to say. You could argue overuse, so it's a fair point. The facts, however, are that if you like entertainment, this is very good entertainment, and it's rather scary because this villa's got a dreadful past. Children here were into the hospital, and children were here reportedly, or so it's thought, interned during a plague previously. And so, as it goes down the centuries with the past, so you've got music and you've got special effects to match, and there's absolutely no doubt that whereas this may be melodramatic, it is. It's atmospheric. We have this intrusive music, we have a more serious Poirot Branagh, and also the fact that post-war, it begins with We'll Meet Again with Dame Vera Lynn singing. And you get the impression Poirot is world-weary, like much of Europe. And novelist Adrian Oliver, played by Tina Fey, a very good host, by the way, with Amy Poehler, if I remember the Globes and the Oscars, she convinces Poirot to attend a seance at the palazzo of an opera singer, Rowena Drake, played by Kelly Reilly. Now, the idea is that Poirot will help expose a medium, Joyce Reynolds, played by Michelle Yeoh. But during the seance, firstly, Poirot discovers an assistant up a chimney, and secondly, there's no doubt that Reynolds is speaking in the voice of the departed one. There has been a voice, a disappearance of Alicia. Alicia is Rowena Drake's daughter, and she tragically fell to her death, or could there have been more to it? So Reynolds and Poirot have an argument, and then she puts her cloak and mask on him, something that's most unlikely, by the way, certainly not a way to behave to Agatha Christie's detective. However, he's then attacked and nearly drowned, and then Reynolds is found impaled on a light. And then we have our little gathering, the little gathering of those who were attending the séance, who had contacts of one sort or another with Alicia. And then Poirot's starting to get hallucinations, hearing voices, and very strange things going on in various parts of this villa. Having said that is really all those who want to go and see this film really need to know of the plot. It's very entertaining. Firstly, I got the, unlike Natasha, I got the murderer wrong. I have to say, I was never much good at this. I used to read Agatha Christie novels and almost invariably got the murderer wrong. The only time I ever got it right was when I did a complete guess. The shots of Venice here, very, very atmospheric, as I've praised Brandon's Poirot, which I didn't expect to do. I mean, the whole thing, if you want to make fun of a movie like this, it's not very difficult. The various shots, the seance, which is way over the top, all the rest of it. But if you want something to enjoy, something that is going to keep you on the edge of your seat, even if you're not entirely convinced by what's happening, facts of the matter are, this is a pretty good bet for it. So I enjoyed it. It's good entertainment.
And your score, Richard?
Would be 8 out of 10.
Matches that, Ashes. Extraordinary. Fia van den Bogaert, given that 7 days ago you didn't even know who Hercule Poirot was or happened to be, and I do think it's actually essential that we celebrate the moustache effectively on these kind of things. I'm saddened that I seem to be the only soul who is actually engaging in the moustache. Richard, you've let us down on this one, but never mind. Fia, is this one for yourself? Given obviously it's about a Belgian detective and you are in the Netherlands.
I know. I mean, I think I couldn't rock the moustache like you do. So I don't think I should wear a moustache from now on. But no, I think the movie was great. And I mean, I enjoyed it. It was very entertaining. So very scary, which is not really something that I really like in movies. But because of the mystery part of it, I liked it, I guess. And of course, I did my research into Poirot because I didn't know him until last week. And I actually discovered that Agatha Christie didn't even like him.
No, she was much more of a Miss Marple fan. Quite understandable. Yeah. Kenneth Branagh, of course, loves Hercule. He even actually featured the book, which is the inspiration behind The Haunting in Venice, in his movie Belfast. It's opened under a Christmas tree present. You know, all those little nods in the direction of the Branagh oeuvre, which people have appreciated, which is to say, once again, puts him way ahead of David Suchet from my point of view. Sarah Huntley, have you seen this one as yet? Or is it a case of A Haunting in Venice? I'm dealing with A Haunting in Dulwich. Have you seen my teaching recently?
Well, I think we all agree. I rather suit this moustache, actually. I think you could do a thumbs up, everybody. I think you could handle this very well, Alexius. Mm. It looks really rather good. Sophie, I wish the viewers could see. It looks excellent. And you could also do a sideline in just one Cornetto ice cream as well, I think, you know, with that moustache.
Variety is vital in education in the world today.
Yeah. Actually, well, I'm sneakily going to try and go and see it this evening, if I possibly can. No, as I said last week, it's definitely one I would love to go and see.
Okay. Fia, having seen it, what's the score from your own point of view?
I think I actually agree with Richard and Natasha. It's an 8 out of 10. It's very good.
There you go.
I mean, it's like Agatha Christie.
Well, Once Upon a Crime, of course, is a movie which we didn't dare hand over to Richard to provide the routine for, because he'd instantly actually give spoilers, and we can't give any spoilers at all about this particular package.
I can't believe you're perpetrating what I can only call his lies.
Yes, methinks you do protest too much. But Yuichi Fukuda has actually produced something which, whilst not an uproarious, sensational success, and I have to say, the killer in the end, I think, is perfectly justified given the atrocious way in which the pet pigeon was actually buried. You know, these are the crucial things that we've actually got from that point of view. And obviously, we know it's the evil sister who gives problems with respect to that. But it is, of course, the kingdom of Claire de Lune. Natasha, share with us, Once Upon a Crime, does Little Red Riding Hood match Hercule Poirot in terms of detective logic?
Oh, Alex, I can't believe you've done... Actually, I can't believe you've done this. This movie, I'm going to go right off the bat and say that I actually enjoyed this more than A Haunting in Venice, but I'm probably in the minority for that.
I would agree with you. I would agree with you. It does work, especially for the Arigato numbers.
Did you watch it in Japanese, Alex, or did you watch it in English?
No, obviously I'm going to watch it in Japanese with subtitles.
Good
I mean,
man.
This is the essential
man.
Way.
So yeah, this movie is available in both English and is available in the original Japanese, and you can have English subtitles. Obviously open to the listener, however they would like to listen to it. Personally, with these sort of things, I like to listen to the original language in which they're originally shot. So I did watch this one in Japanese, and I felt like it worked because of the humor that you've got in it. This is a very Japanese styled comedy. I'm going to dub it spicy panto, right? That's the kind of vibe you kind of get with this one. So it's based on a 2020 novel by the same name. And it features some really interesting character performances. So you start off with the main character, who is Little Red Riding Hood, and she's played by Kana Hashimoto. And she's gone out into the woods to sort of see the world. And she's on this journey of discovery as she sort of grows up. And right off the bat, she meets this very quirky, very over sort of enthused witch.
Yeah, but the witch does not do shoes.
She does not do shoes.
Everything else
unfortunately,
fine.
And unfortunately, whilst trying to prove how magical and amazing she is, she decides to soak poor Red Riding Hood's boots in mud, resulting in her having to wash them in the local stream. Now, once again, the witch pops up and distracts her, and her poor boots float down the river and are found by another interesting familiar story.
Cinderella.
Cinderella, played by Yuko Araki. And she's stolen Red's boots and she's got them on her feet. And she's obviously confronted by Red Riding Hood, who notices that she's quite upset, quite distressed, and next to a grave. When asked about what's happened, she sort of regales this whole sort of sob story about how she's bullied by her sisters and her stepmother because she's not beautiful. Her pet pigeon has been killed and buried in the grave. And she's very distressed. She's got cuts all over her feet. She's in raggedy clothes. She's ostracized from society because in this kingdom, the only thing that matters is if you're beautiful. But she's got this ball coming up tonight and she really wants to go. And thus, you see the general fairy godmother appear. In this case, once again, the same witch who does not do shoes. Thankfully, her niece, who does do glass slippers and is a little forthcoming with the magic, manages to sort
them out. Only for a limited time period.
But only for 24 hours, that is correct. Unlike the witch, whose rather stylish staff is very impressive, her magic only lasts till the stroke of midnight. Off they go to the ball with their sort of pumpkin carriage and their very hilarious mouse coach driver, who standout performance. It was really, really good. I chuckled so much at all he had to say. Unfortunately, on the way there, they hit a body. Initially, they think that they've struck and killed this poor man, who turns out to be the royal hairdresser.
He deserved to die. Mr. Hans is not a healthy man.
But luckily for them, or maybe not luckily for them, he was already dead when the carriage hits. And this is something that Red, who's got quite a lot of intuition, manages to work out rather quickly. So you're starting to see Little Red Riding Hood get put into this detective role. As they go to the ball, they have a lovely time until the guards announce that they found a dead body in the woods. And it happens to be
a buzzkill, Natasha. It was a classic buzzkill. You're having a great time at the ball. A guard comes in and announces there's a dead body in the woods. The whole atmosphere takes a turn for the worse. I know. Sarah will have been at those events.
It did. It really killed the whole vibe. Fortunately for them, whilst the royal household itself is rather incompetent, Little Red Riding Hood figures out that she might be helpful in this cause and up she goes and starts.
Detective Little Red Riding Hood.
Detective Little Red Riding Hood, and thus a lot more chaos ensues. This is a really fun movie. I won't say any more because I'm not giving spoilers this week.
No, you're not Richard. No, it's perfectly understandable. I go with that.
It's a really fun movie. You have to be in a certain mood, I think, to watch this movie because it is very silly and pantomime-esque. It very much draws on sort of kabuki and that sort of long-running gags and the stereotyped characters. It is very silly, but it brought me so much joy and so much happiness just watching it unfold. And unlike A Haunting in Venice, I actually didn't work out who the killer was at the start. It was much longer into the plot progression before I worked out who the killer was. So that has something one up on A Haunting in Venice. Not that I'm discrediting A Haunting in Venice, because that is also a great movie. I think that this is a movie that's going to be very controversial with the viewer. It's kind of done meh online. It's sitting at about a 5 out of 10 for a lot of people online. You either kind of love it or you kind of hate it. I came across this actually because it was recommended to me via social media. And so they're obviously doing their job correctly. They're always listening. But it was a really good hit. And the people commenting on it on my social media feed really, really loved it. So as I say, I think it's a bit like Marmite. You're either going to really like this movie in the Japanese style of comedy that it is, or you're gonna switch it off in the first 5 minutes. I think it's gonna go one of those two ways. You're gonna go know very quickly whether you're in on board or not. But thankfully, as it's Netflix, you can switch it off in the first 5 minutes if you realize you don't like it. But please do persevere through the first 5 minutes, because it does get good. The first 5 minutes are a little bit choppy, but go through because it is excellent. I believe they're going to make this into a series. There are talks.
There are lots of adventures for Little Red Riding Hood or Detective Red Riding Hood to explore, and we look forward to those clearly. Apart from the fact that Mr. Hans deserved to die and they shouldn't have killed the pigeon, Fia, would you go for this? Is this something which you'd actually say, yes, I'm going to listen to that in the original Japanese?
Well, this is a lot to digest. I do love the concept about just everyone grew up with Cinderella and Little Red Riding Hood and just giving them like it's such a different story, but it's also kind of the same, like how it has the ball and you have to be back at midnight, and it sounds very interesting, and I mean I love a mystery, so I will watch it. Not if you convince me.
Yeah, in the Kingdom of Claire de Lune, Sarah Huntley. Clearly, it'd probably be just Richard and myself, maybe just myself, who wouldn't be allowed into the Kingdom of Claire de Lune. But Sarah, would you go for this?
Well, Natasha's energy and joy of it is a seller in itself. So, yes, I definitely would. Yeah.
Your score, Natasha?
This is going to be controversial. I'm going to 8.5. I really enjoyed this one. A lot of people will disagree with me, but it brought me so much happiness and pleasure on my Saturday morning when I was watching it.
I think I probably had it at 7, but primarily because, again, Mr. Hans deserved to die. Richard Fitzwilliams, is this one that you feel, yes, how could I possibly, given my fondness for murder mysteries, not check out Detective Little Red Riding Hood?
It does sound charming, and Natasha served it very well, but I'm intrigued. Natasha, you've been allowed 0.5 points. Now, that sets a precedent, I think, so I will have
I've never disallowed 0.5 points, Richard. I've always said 0.5 points are actually there.
They've never come up, but I always feel that one should be able to mark a movie exactly how one feels. So, you know, I think it's a good sell for something that does sound charming.
Well, Richard, what's the lesson for this then? Can we learn a lesson? How can we actually go with that?
Well, this is a movie that actually scores rather highly on Rotten Tomatoes. And I do have to say, if it was by the cast alone, if you could list a cast, Richard E. Grant, Judy Dumpy, Daryl McCormack, if that were possible, I think this would score very, very highly. Unfortunately, it isn't possible. And the reason that it isn't possible is that you need, obviously, to give good performers a good script, and a script which is convincing enough in a thriller of this sort. It's certainly diverting. It's actually quite an entertaining movie. But, well, here's the plot, some of the plot. An aspiring writer, Liam Sommers, played by Daryl McCormack, remember him opposite Emma Thompson, who's hires him for sex in a most entertaining movie recently. She's playing this aspiring writer. He's hired by the Sinclair family as a tutor to help their son Bertie, played by Stephen McMillan. Now, Bertie is studying English literature. What else could he be studying because his father is J.K. Sinclair, played by Richard E. Grant, who's one of England's finest writers and also happens to be the subject of Liam's...
Good writers borrow, great writers steal.
Yes, I know, and there are all sorts of aspects of that, which, if you were to go further into it, might reveal spoilers we wouldn't want to, Alex, we wouldn't.
No, I'll leave that to you, Richard.
Very kind, very kind. Also, Sinclair is writing, having written nothing for a long time, he's writing a new novel, he needs a proofreader, so as well as being a tutor, so another good task for Liam, you might think. The family have been very traumatized by the death of their son, Felix. This haunts them all, and you can feel there's something haunting everybody by the way they're behaving, because quite honestly, if you want to have dinner with this family, I wouldn't recommend it if you want to laugh. Indeed not. And it's also clear because the camera can't keep away from it. Indeed, it goes back to the pond in their garden. They have a luxury mansion. They've got a butler and servants, all the rest of it. But usually when in a movie, I've found this, there's a whole variety of them. When people are really rich and ostentatiously so, like the Sinclairs, and the film makes a great deal of the staff and the mansion and the beautiful gardens and so on, that there's a lot of something that they're hiding and something that may be very, very bizarre that's being hidden, which of course it is. Why does the camera keep giving us these endless shots of the lake so early? Could it be trying to tell us something? Well, indeed, of
deep
course.
Waters, it... Richard, deep waters. It's a metaphor.
All that, yes. And the twists start coming into the plot. The trouble is they're terribly, terribly artificial. The story becomes a bit melodramatic. There's a lot of very loud music here. Yes, you've got some very fine performers, but the trouble with Richard E. Grant's novelist is that he overplays it. He's almost certainly been forced to do so by a director, in this case, Alice Troughton, who's made him a caricature rather than a character. That is the problem. Because if you think back to this film, it's Richard E. Grant making all sorts of weird faces and that sort of thing. And that is not what you should be thinking of. Daryl McCormack as Liam, yes, it's fine diction. It's got a pleasing presence. I think it's really an actor on the up. Judy Delpy, as Helene Sinclair, yes, appropriately glacial. She does the stuff. The film is, from time to time, it is entertaining. But the trouble is, if you're creating something really pretentious, and this is, of course it's about literature. Great writers, indeed. We tell their steel and so on. And when it begins, as Tar began, with Q&A in front of an audience, and when it's brought up to Sinclair that the death of his son has affected him and his writing, he storms off. You might think there's nothing particularly strange in that, but on the other hand, well, it's a movie, you see, it's divided into sections, into literary chapters, and it just so happens that the tutor, when he sees anything on the printed page, he can remember it verbatim. Indeed, if you read
the book, photographic memory, or eidetic memory, to be precise.
I think if you have hundreds of pages in a manuscript and happen to see them once, I don't think it's very likely you'll be able to reproduce them. You might if you were a genius, but it's very unlikely. Anyway, allowing for that, the problem with the movie is it's so, ending, for example, so dramatically neat. I felt shortchanged, and most particularly because I wasn't convinced by it, and I keep getting images that it's too slick, too clever by half, and Richard D. Grant makes too many faces. A pity, because this could have been really chilling and really ingenious, and bits of it are.
Amusing but contrived, according to The Guardian. I suspect you're going to go for a 6 out of 10 for this one, Richard.
I'm afraid four.
Oh, my word. Fear, is this a lesson that's worth learning from your own point of view?
Average writers attempt originality, but the greats, great writers, steal.
But your personal life seeps into your work.
If you're asking whether my son's death has inspired my writing, the answer is no. I will not be writing about his death. I will be writing in spite of it.
Good morning. You must be Bertie.
So you're my tutor.
Your father. He's the most revered writer in the country.
My husband, the subject of your thesis. You're not here for him. So don't talk about his work. Don't talk about Felix. Follow those rules and you should be fine.
It's only been 2 years since. Felix, Lake's off limits. Don't do it again.
You know, Liam's a writer too. I've seen the novel. It's actually quite good.
You know you're not the first.
There have been incidents in the past.
When you said I wasn't the first, what did you mean?
I have a new novel, and I was wondering if you might be on hand for the final stretch. Thought you might like to help.
We did all we could to save Felix, but it was too late. My husband was always hard to please.
You're changing my work.
I'm not.
Who's the writer?
This isn't about the writing.
It was only ever about the writing, Liam.
Why does he lock the door if he's got nothing to hide? I want to know. Don't you?
It's like nothing you've written before. But the ending, it feels like a different novel.
Liam, good writers borrow.
Great writers steal.
Yeah, you're right. I haven't been able to see the movie yet, but it doesn't really feel like I should now. I mean,
if only for those faces by Richard E. Grant. Surely that's what the big screen's made for. Sarah Huntley, gurning on screen. I mean, surely that's got to be a plus factor.
Yes. I mean, Richard E. Grant has certain mannerisms, which I'm quite fond of. But if they go out of the remit of the film to take away from it, then perhaps it's a no. I mean, I'm with Nell and I, as I always think of Richard E. Grant, and he has had a pretty difficult time in the last couple of years, losing his wife and everything. So perhaps he's just going back into this with a bit too much gusto. I don't know. I think it'll be one that when it comes on Netflix and I've got a pile of ironing, I'll think, ooh, I'll see what I think.
Or other streaming services which are available. Natasha, one for yourself?
Well, I feel rather disappointed to you because the trailer actually made it look like a really interesting, really sort of provoking plot. But to find out that it's kind of over-dramatized and a bit of a damp squiff is a bit disappointing. But maybe if it's on a plane at some point, but I don't think I'll probably be, that's my usual Richard, as you know, but I don't think I'll be going to a cinema to see this now.
Well, as I say, for time-traveling people, we'll be pleased to know that President Macron of France had a very important meeting this week, a very significant one which I found particularly moving, particularly in Marseille, in the Velodrome, when, of course, he met His Holiness the Pope. I believe he also played ping pong with some minor head of some minor English country somewhere who basically was upstaged by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak saying, no, we're going to forget this green agenda. It's just nonsense. Let's put it to one side. Richard, anything you'd like to say about Pope Francis, or are you going to be referring to the current incumbent of the Windsor household?
Well, of course, when it comes to ping pong, Brigitte Macron versus Queen Camilla. I mean, they were both
abs. It's not like Ireland, South Africa in the Rugby World Cup, is it?
Not quite. No. They were both really bad. I mean, it's harmless, it's a bit of fun, but most people, fortunately, wouldn't have seen it. So far as the visit was concerned, I think very grand. I mean, it had been postponed since March, and I mean, I thought Macron and King Charles got on pretty well because, I mean, in the banquet at Versailles, the king made a joke that it was worth waiting for. And I mean, the French were very embarrassed indeed.
That's even worse than the king in the Kingdom of Clair de Lune in Once Upon a Crime, to be honest, but never mind.
Well, I have to say, overall, you have the lighting, the relighting of the eternal flame at the under the Arc de Triomphe. You have the flypast. You've got the Elysee, which I've been round. It really is very, very magnificent. And you've got Versailles, which, of course, is always a super colossal, super spectacle. And add in Arsene Wenger and Hugh Grant and Mick Jagger. And you've got a good guest list as well. And then you've got the address to the Senate, and clearly defence and climate change were the central motifs of it, as well as appreciation for the French response when Queen Elizabeth died, which was, I thought, very moving. Macron saying that to you, she's your queen, to us, she's the queen. No, I thought it went very well. I see they had HMS Iron Duke in Bordeaux. The Iron Duke, of course, is a nickname for the Duke of Wellington. And I seem to remember when Nicolas Sarkozy came over on a state visit during Queen Elizabeth's reign, they renamed the Waterloo Chamber at Windsor Castle the Music Room for a night when, I think it was a cast of Les Miserables performed. But yes, I mean, I think it went very well. I think also Entente Cordiale, dating from Edward VII, he inspired it. I think it's very important post-Brexit.
But not as well as the papal visit to the Velodrome. Anyway, Sarah, anything else you'd like to add in our closing moments?
Well, I'd like to say that I went to see What a Twat last night with Dawn French at the Palladium. And
I didn't think you could even say that on Siren Radio, but you have, so what the hey?
Oh, well, I'm sorry. Well, that's what it was called.
yeah, that's fine.
It was absolutely brilliant. And I felt a bit drained this week under going to that. It was so uplifting. And the premise is it's her, a one-woman show, with a huge screen behind her. I won't say that word again then. Explaining moments where she has been a bit of a silly girl.
Silly girl, better.
A silly girl. Which we all...
Totally without any thought, if you want to use an acronym.
No, but she did it brilliantly and sort of unlike Miriam Margolyes, managed to damn people in a way that you thought, oh my goodness me, you'd be laughing at yourself if you were listening to yourself here. But the one I really liked was when she was explaining she was doing another one-woman show many years ago in the West End. And she was on her own in a show. And, you know, although the crew were lovely, she was feeling a bit, well, you need a bit of company. So her show finished just before another show, which some mates were in, which will come to me, that it was a very serious play, a three-hander. Oh, anyway, it was literally next door to the theatre she was at. And she thought, oh, I know, I'll go and see them after the show. And because she's obviously didn't say this, but because who she is, she went through the stage door and she was watching them finish their show. Just decided to come on and take a bow in a totally different show at the end. And she said that was a very naughty thing to do. But I can understand. You just think, well, I'm here. I might just do it, which was
the equivalent. It's the actor's equivalent of photo bombing, basically, or soaking up that whole.
But she actually did it to herself at the end of this show, because what was rather wonderful was right at the end. She was marvellous and great energy and really fun. And it was just
like Richard E. Grant in The Lesson.
Yes. But he wasn't doing a one-man show, was he?
Well, he might have been trying to. That's why he did all those facial expressions.
Oh, well, perhaps that was... But what she then did was she comes on at the end and she's saying about how bad she is at singing, which I totally understand. And my daughter's going, well, it's really like you, Mum, with your career. And I went, yeah, it is actually, because some of the stories she was... If you're a bit of an old fez, it's very, very like that. But the thing she said at the end, she said, I really would like, just please, could you just bear with me? And I want to do this last song, As Long As He Needs Me, from Oliver. And we had to all pretend that she could sing. And, oh, she was very funny. Anyway, she did this. And then she goes off, comes on, and who does she pull on? Jennifer Saunders, who'd obviously come to see her that night, and then rubbishes her and throws her off stage.
She might have just come to take a bow, that's all, basically.
She was mimicking what she'd done. So I can say, if you'd like to feel uplifted, and just have fun and think life is good, really do go and see that. And it's she's also writing it down with other occasions of when she was a silly girl.
Well, if you got that opportunity to make some money, why wouldn't you? After all, it's a retirement routine.
Oh, Alexis, don't be so cynical. That's very naughty. No, no, no. No, she'd worked... Oh, God, do I know? When I've had to do performances on my own, you work incredibly hard and it's really, really stressful. She had written that... No, I'm sorry, please, I am not taking that comment. As equity, I will tell you that she put 150% into that show.
Indeed. And much could be said about The Signalman, which is a wonderful production of Charles Dickens, which is going around the East Midlands as well, which was excellently received at the Lincoln New Theatre Royal recently. To Sarah Huntley, to Fia van den Bogert, to Natasha Wanton, and to Richard Fitzwilliams, thank you as ever. And keep watching those movies or checking out those papal visits or indeed indulging yourself in actors' tales about actors.
I'm sitting in the morning at the diner on the corner. I am waiting at the counter for the man to pour the coffee, and he fills it only halfway. And before I even argue, he is looking out the window at somebody coming in. It is always nice to see you, says the man behind the counter to the woman who has come in. She is shaking her umbrella, and I look the other way as they are kissing their hellos, and I'm pretending not to see them, and instead I pour the milk. I open up the paper, there's a story of an actor who had died while he was drinking. It was no one I had heard of, and I'm turning to the horoscope and looking for the funnies when I'm feeling someone watching me, and so I raise my head. There's a woman on the outside looking inside. Does she see me? No, she does not really see me, 'cause she sees her own reflection, and I'm trying not to notice that she's hitching up her skirt, and while she's straightening her stockings, her hair has gotten wet. Oh, this rain, it will continue through the morning as I'm listening to the bells of the cathedral. I am thinking of your voice and of the midnight picnic once upon a time before the rain began. And I finish up my coffee and it's time to catch the train.